Elizabeth, more and more scientists say we have now entered a new age of mass extinction. What are the projections for the kinds of species that are headed for extinction?
Well, you know, one of the defining characteristics actually of a mass extinction, which are really just defined as these moments in time, and you know, you have to understand moment broadly here as a geological moment, not a moment in human terms. They're just defined as these moments when the diversity of life on the planet very suddenly contracts. And one of their features, is the diversity of life very suddenly contracts. And the other is that is a sort of across-the-board phenomenon. So
there's kind of a general collapse.
Exactly. And if only one sort of group were collapsing, it probably would not rise to the level of a mass extinction. And obviously, some groups do better than others, and scientists have spent a lot of time trying to discern what that is. For example, insects seem to do okay in mass extinctions, although there are mass extinctions where insects have suffered very badly too. So it's a somewhat, you know, fuzzy definition, but really one of the definitions, as I say, is that goes across classes and orders and groups of organisms.
So given, I mean, current projections, and granted scientists don't really know what's going to happen, but lots of mammals, lots of amphibians, lots of birds are likely to disappear?
Well, one of the reasons that we know, you know, quote unquote, know that we are certainly, if not in a mass extinction, certainly we have very, very elevated rates of extinction, the sort of rates you would, you know, expect to see if you were heading into a mass extinction, is that scientists look at groups of animals generally that we know very well. So one of the problems with looking at extinction rates, right, is that we don't know the number in the denominator. We don't know how many species there are on Earth. Even some people would say, to an order of magnitude. We just don't know. Are we talking 10 million? Are we talking 100 million? So what scientists do is we look at groups that we know pretty well. So mammals are a group, for example, that you pretty rarely find a new mammal. Very occasionally you do, but pretty rarely. So we think we have a pretty good handle on how many species of mammals there are on the planet. And then scientists look at, okay, how many have gone extinct? How many are critically endangered, and how fast are they passing through these stages of endangerment toward extinction? And it turns out that when you look at that, something like a quarter of all mammals right now are threatened with extinction.
A quarter of all mammals?
Yes. It's a very, very high number, a very scary number. And one thing that I think, you know, really makes an impression on people, or should make an impression on people, is all of our very closest relatives, of humanity's very closest relatives, are threatened with extinction.
You're talking about the other primates.
Imminently. Well, I'm talking about the other great apes. I'm talking about orangutans. I'm talking about gorillas. I'm talking about chimps. I'm talking about bonobos. So those are our very closest relatives, and they are all endangered. In some cases, very, very just hanging on. And that, I think, should really, if there's any sort of fact about what's going on that I think should really grab people and does grab people, it is that.
Mm-hmm. But it goes way beyond that. I mean, just reading your books, the projections are what? A third of all sharks and rays likely to disappear? A fifth of all reptiles? A sixth of all birds?
Well, these are not just likely to disappear. I mean, these are already, you know, on the way to extinction. And the most, you know, threatened group of all right now is amphibians, actually. Something like 40% of amphibians are classified as in danger, and there's been a real spate of extinctions. Hmm. There are just many, you know, fantastic frogs and toads that you cannot find anymore.
Oh, tell me about one of those species of frogs.
Sure. Well, the species that I begin my book with, actually, and the whole, what's been called the amphibian crisis was really one of the spurs that got me involved in this whole project. So the species is called the Panamanian golden frog. It's actually technically a toad, if people are interested in that technical distinction, but it's called a frog. And it's a very, very beautiful animal. It's a very bright yellow, the color of sort of a New York City taxi cab. is very poisonous. If you know, another animal eats it, it probably doesn't fare too well. And it communicate. They communicate with each other. They live near running water, and they don't hear very well, and they don't have a call. Many frogs call. But instead, they sort of wave. They have this like semaphore, and there's video of them waving, and it's very, very moving. So anyway, they were driven. They're extinct in the wild now. You can only find them in a couple of zoos, and in this special facility that was built for them in Panama. Because what happened was that people realized that there was this disease that was passing through the rainforest, passing through Panama. It had already sort of passed through Costa Rica. It was heading east through Panama.
And this was recent, right?
It was quite recent that this happened. This was back in 2006. And it took a long time to figure out what was happening to amphibians in Central America, because one of the very weird things is that amphibians were disappearing. People were going to places that are as untouched as a place can be in the world in the 21st century, and finding that frogs that they had been monitoring for, you know, years were suddenly gone.
And so this is not a case of humans clearing the rainforest and the amphibians disappearing.
Exactly. So there was a lot of controversy. There was a lot of head scratching. And eventually people figured out, it wasn't that eventual. It took about a decade, let's say. They figured out that a fungal disease was passing through, and you could watch that disease move. So people very cleverly predicted, smartly predicted, okay, we're watching this. It's moving east. In this case, it had to do with the flow of water, probably, and the way the water was moving this fungus, which has a swimming stage. And so they said, okay, we know the Panamanian golden frog is in the way of this. It has a pretty restricted range. It's in imminent danger. Let's take as many as we can out of the rainforest and put them in this sterile facility. It is like a biosecure facility. But what happened was that before they could build this facility, they started to notice that frogs were dying, and they realized they had to move faster than they thought. And so literally, these frogs ended up being put up in a hotel. And that is how I learned about this story, actually. There was a story in National Geographic Kids called like the Great Frog Hotel or something. And it was sort of a fun story. But to me, about saving frogs, these wonderful frogs. And it was a nice story for kids. And my kids got the magazine. But to me, it was sort of a panic-inducing story. It was really, wow, this is what we've come to.
Because it happened so fast.
Yes.
And it's sort of like there was one place to save this particular species.
Exactly. And the more you sort of look into what's happening to amphibians, the more, you know, it sort of heartbreaking and devastating it is. And I went down to Panama, and I actually, you know, got to see some of these wonderful frogs that had been rescued from the rainforest. And one of the really things that really made a big impression on me, besides the Panamanian golden frogs, which, as I said, are quite beautiful and lovely animals, was that they found a frog in the process of this, trying to get as many frogs as they could into captivity. They took into captivity this sort of gawky-looking frog called the Rab's tree-limbed frog, I believe. And it had just recently been found, you know, just before this disease came through. And there were, at the time that I visited this place, there were three that they knew of in existence. And now I believe there is one left. And when that frog dies, that will probably be the last of his kind. And it's such a, when you actually, you know, have seen in your own lifetime an animal go extinct, one of the points I try to make in the book is that is something that should not be possible in a human lifetime. Now, if you are now, certainly if you are studying amphibians, you have almost certainly watched a species go extinct. And almost any group you are studying now, it is quite entirely possible that in the short span of time that, you know, a human career lasts, a naturalist, an ecologist, will watch a species go extinct. And that in and of itself is a tip off that we are in an extinction crisis, because, you know, normally in the vast expanse of sort of time, a species should last for about a million years.
Hmm. I mean, and the way you talk about this, it's almost as if the scientists who are dedicated to trying to save these species, they're setting up these little, what are the equivalent of Noah's arks? You know, these little repositories of trying to get a few breeding animals that can carry on the species.
Yes, no, absolutely. There's a project called Amphibian Ark, and that is explicitly what it's about, and more species, and I can go down a list of animals I have seen, you know, personally, that are one of, let's say, there's 100 left in the world, there's 200 left in the world. We can identify every individual that's left. And, you know, one of the questions that comes up in that, and that's getting a little bit maybe far afield in this conversation, is, you know, when you're down to that level, we're very good at that point at sort of keeping these populations alive for a certain amount of time, but you can have terrible, you know, the question of whether those animals are really, there's ever any possibility that they can repopulate the wild is a very, very open question.
I mean, essentially what you're describing is zoos will be the repository of certain species, possibly quite a large number of species.
Absolutely. And I recently did a piece actually for National Geographic on zoos and one of the and how they are becoming these sort of, you know, arcs, as you say. And one of the points that some of the people in various zoos, top zoos who have very, very, you know, extensive conservation projects, both in the countries where these animals are and also in the States, is look, the whole world is becoming a zoo. So even if, you know, we are managing a small population of these animals, even if we're managing them in their, where they live, you know, we are still managing them and they are a very small population. And the skills that zoos now have of, you know, trying to keep genetic diversity, as much genetic diversity as you can in a very small population, they're now transferring to wild population, you know, so-called wild populations. So that is another really, really, when I heard that, I was like, yeah, that's true. And that's really alarming.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine, for instance, we know mountain gorillas are, you know, very rare in Rwanda, for instance. And, you know, they try to protect them, but it's, you know, it's, you know, they're poachers and, you know, can you, I mean, essentially it's sort of like a zoo, but in the wild.
Absolutely. And there are many, many increasingly, you know, both facilities like that, those mountain gorillas, you know, their identities are known, their habits are known. They know when one is missing. So that mountain gorilla, those mountain gorilla populations are very carefully monitored, not necessarily kept safe because it's very, very hard to do that. But increasingly, that's the case where even if animals are out there sort of foraging for themselves, they are still being monitored and have to be protected. And if they were not, they would be extinct pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. So we've already talked about the cause of at least a certain class of species that are going extinct, this fungus that is, is wiping out a lot of frog populations, for instance. What are other causes of extinction?
Well, just to say that this fungal disease is emblematic of a bigger problem, which is a cause of one sort of class of extinctions, if you will, and that is that we're moving species around the world. So that fungus was probably moved around the world, you know, by people moving other amphibians around the world
inadvertently.
Inadvertently, we did not know that these amphibians were carrying this fungus, but we did it, and now it's everywhere, practically everywhere in the world. And so that phenomenon of moving species around, and you hear about this all the time, right? You know, there are zebra mussels, there are Asian carp, all these things that could potentially wipe out native species. So that's one driver of extinction, moving animals, bringing together these evolutionary lineages that have not, you know, seen each other for tens of millions of years. And in some cases, you bring together things that are deadly for each other. So that's one driver of extinction. Another driver that I talk about is, you know, one that everybody knows about. It's habitat loss, habitat fragmentation. We are sort of turning the world into these little sets of islands where there are maybe protected patches of rainforest. But one thing that we know is that the smaller the area, the fewer species it's going to contain. So as we contract what used to be these vast expanses of contiguous forest, we have a pretty good sense that we're driving a lot of species extinct.
And this, I presume, would come from the human population that keeps growing and there is more development.
Yes, exactly. I mean, for example, you know, when I was working on that chapter, I went to visit a project that's been running for a long time in the Amazon, where they, in an interesting experiment, as they were raising the forest, a scientist named Tom Lovejoy intervened and got them to preserve these little patches so he could watch and see what happened. And that experiment's now been running for 35 years and it has produced a lot of interesting results. But if you take the Amazon, you know, as everyone knows, large stretches of it are gone now. And while the Brazilian government had been somewhat successful at limiting deforestation in recent years, just recently new figures were published that deforestation is up again, and some of that's legal and some of that's illegal, but it all has the same effect.
Mm-hmm. And what about climate change? Is that having much of an impact on extinction rates?
Well, climate change is a big, because there are so many of them, but a big sort of looming threat. I don't think that we have any species that have been, you know, definitively driven extinct by climate change, but we can certainly see a lot of species that are on the move, which totally makes sense, right? If you're changing the climate, then species that are adapted to a certain climate have to try to track that.
So in other words, if they can, they will literally be moving closer to the poles and up in elevation,
exactly.
Like up mountain slopes.
Exactly. So if the climate's warming, you need to move right either to a higher latitude or a higher elevation to try to, you know, keep in your climate mm-hmm. range. And there's vast amounts of evidence, you know, that species are doing that. We find species now at latitudes and elevations that, you know, just 20 years ago we didn't.
Well, in fact, I saw some number. I don't know if this is accurate, that there's an estimate that they're moving something like 30 feet a day.
Well, that's what they need to be moving. In other words, what scientists call the isotherm, so that's like sort of this temperature, you know, belt, that is moving at that rate. So if you wanted to track the climate, and there are different estimates on that, you know, to be honest, 30 feet maybe too high, but basically you have to be moving several feet a day.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about it, of course, if you're a plant, it's really hard,
right,
you know, to move that fast. So there's a lot of people out there looking at, okay, how fast are species actually moving? And some are capable of moving great distances, even trees, right? You put out seeds and your seeds sprout now quite a ways away from where they used to be able to. So, you know, trees are, you know, almost literally moving up the mountainside. And we know that the tree line is moving. And so the question, you know, really is, you know, we're sort of just at the beginning stages of this very, very big climate experiment. And I think one of the questions that scientists ask is, you know, the Earth has been warmer before, long time ago. It was, it's been quite a while now. But have species retained the adaptations to a warmer world of, like, you know, literally we're talking maybe, you know, 50 million years ago? That is sort of an empirical question that, unfortunately, you know, we're going to find out the answer to, whether we want to know it or not. But there are certainly very high projections for species that, for the proportion of species mm-hmm. that could be driven extinct by climate change.
Now, one of the revelations I had reading your book was the impact that climate change is having on oceans. I mean, with these greater levels of carbon dioxide, it's having a huge effect, especially on coral reefs.
Yeah, I think one of the great underreported stories of our time, really, to be frank, is what's happening to the oceans. And what you really need to understand to understand this phenomenon is that when you pump a lot of CO2 into the air, as we're doing, about, you know, 10 billion tons a year of CO2, a lot of it ends up very quickly getting dissolved in the upper layers of the ocean. And when CO2 dissolves in water, it forms an acid, carbonic acid. And it's a weak acid, right? If you drank a Coke today, you drank some carbonic acid, but it is an acid. And we know that the pH, so the chemistry of the water, we know that's changing. We can measure it. People are measuring it. It's indisputable. You know, you have these global warming quote-unquote debates. I'm not going to get into that now. You do not have ocean acidification debates. The ocean is becoming more acidified. That is just beyond question. And when you think about it, right, we don't live in the ocean, so we don't really relate to ocean chemistry. But when you think about it, if you're an organism whose only relationship to the outside world is through the water, then you change the chemistry of the water. That is a big deal.
So what happens then to species in the ocean?
Well, any number of things could happen, right? If I change the pH of your blood by more than a very marginal amount, you'd be dead very quickly. So a lot of organisms put a lot of effort into, you know, maintaining their pH of their body chemistry. But it turns out that a lot of these marine organisms, there's just a limited tolerance that they have. So many different physiological effects could result from climate change. The one that is pretty predictable, or one that is, one of the ones that is quite predictable, is it becomes more difficult for any animal that builds a shell or an external skeleton out of calcium carbonate. So you go to the beach, you pick up an oyster shell that is made out of calcium carbonate. And that becomes harder due to the energetics of that. And we can see that. We can see that it is becoming more difficult. And corals, any coral reef, all they're doing is, you know, assembling calcium carbonate. That is what a coral reef is. It's a lot of calcium carbonate. And we can see that reefs are, you know, having a very hard time. They're having a hard time for a lot of reasons, but ocean acidification is one of them. And if you talk to scientists, and they've written this, this is no secret, you go out and look at the scientific literature, there are very, very few scientists who say that, you know, if we continue to dump CO2 into the air and effectively into the water, that coral reefs will live out this century, okay?
Wow. You mean all the coral reefs in the world could disappear this century?
Yes. And I think people need really to be aware of that, because we are talking about a major change. When there have been times in the past where reefs have disappeared, and they are associated with some of these terrible crises.
And a coral reef has one of the richest collections of biodiversity in the world, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's something called the rainforests of the oceans. And, I in the process of reporting that book, I went to both a rainforest, mm-hmm. the Amazon rainforest, and to the Great Barrier Reef.
In Australia.
Yeah. And I can tell you that the amount of life and the abundance of life and the diversity of life that you see on the Great Barrier Reef is really unequaled anywhere in the world. It is so extraordinary. You feel like you're in a dream landscape.
Tell me, you have this great description of what it was like to go there, and especially walking around at night on a little island on the Great Barrier Reef, which sounds like an amazing experience.
Yeah, I went to this little tiny island called One Tree Island, which actually had more than one tree. I was somewhat disappointed to find out. And it was like, you know, an acre in size, the whole thing. It was just this bit of reef that had sort of been thrown up above the waterline by a big, big storm a couple thousand years ago. And so all around it was reef that was still below the water and still living reef. And the scientists I was with were doing an experiment that required you to walk out about a mile on the reef. You could only do it at low tide. Otherwise, you'd drown. And we would go out in the middle of the night. I would go out with them sometimes. And it was just a spectacular, sometimes rather hair-raising experience to do that. And life, even in the pitch black, where you only have a flashlight beam in front of you, is extraordinary. You know, we would see octopuses and these amazing giant clams that live in the Great Barrier Reef.
You said you sort of had to, like, step over the clams, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And someone told me a very funny story of a scientist who had, I don't know, in a dare or something, stuck his finger in one and had to be, like, extracted. They're very, very tough and strong. And they're very, I mean, when I say giant, I mean giant. They're the size of you know, not quite a bicycle tire, but very, very big.
Wow. So yeah. You were just walking along and seeing this whole incredible array of big animals right
yes.
below you.
Yes. And when you go out during, you know, we would go snorkeling sometimes when these scientists weren't working, when it was high tide. And that is when you really see, you know, you just are looking down onto the reef and the assemblage of fish, you know, the little fish, and I tried to identify them, but I'm not a fish person, but just the extraordinary shapes and colors, and then followed by tuna, who are followed by sharks. You know, it's just, and rays, these incredibly very graceful, beautiful manta rays. It's just, as I say, it's sort of like, you know, when we were kids, when I was a kid, I guess I'm dating myself, you know, you watch the underwater world of Jacques Cousteau, and that, right. that's what I felt like I had fallen into one of those episodes.
Now, to back up for a moment, put this whole discussion yeah. of mass extinctions in some historical perspective, this is actually a fairly new idea, right? I mean, historically, the whole idea that there could be mass extinctions, even extinctions, period.
Yes. Well, one of the interesting things about the history of extinction as a concept, which predates evolution by about a generation or two generations even maybe, is that the person who first sort of theorized extinction, if you want to put it in those terms, was a French naturalist named Georges Cuvier, who lived right around the time of the French Revolution, came to Paris right around the time of the Revolution, right around the turn of the 18th to 19th centuries. And he was the first person. Before that, the sort of prevailing theory, once again, if you want to call it a theory, was, okay, you know, if God put a species on the planet, why would he take it away? It just didn't make any sense. And yet there was growing evidence. And one of the interesting things about that is it has to do with the exploration of the New World. People found these weird bones, and in particular mastodon bones, which come from North America, and they shipped them back to France, including to Europe, including a big shipment that went to Paris. And what was weird about mastodons was that they have teeth that look like human teeth, but they have tusks, obviously, and bones that look like elephants. And so people really scratched their heads about that one and tried to think that, you know, maybe there were two animals that had died, you know, on top of each other. But Georges Cuvier realized, okay, this is one animal, and that animal is extinct. And he just sort of stated that flat out, and it made sense of a lot of this weird evidence, as I say, that was coming in. But he originally, his theory was that all extinctions were mass extinctions. So animals went extinct in these big waves. And one of the things that convinced him of that was seeing these large animals that had all gone out fairly recently at the same time, which we now think of as the megafauna extinction, and which we now think of as something that was caused by human beings.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's a fascinating little sort of historical anecdote here. So right after Cuvier sort of started talking about these extinctions, this in the early 1800s, Thomas Jefferson heard about this, and didn't he tell Lewis and Clark, you know, see if you find any mastodons?
Well, Thomas Jefferson was really interested in fossils, and one of the first things he did, was there was a mastodon, a very famous mastodon skeleton found in Newburgh, New York, so in upstate New York, the Hudson Valley, in, I guess, 1799. And people may know the painting by Charles Wilson Peale called The Exhumation of the Mastodon. It's a wonderful painting. And Thomas Jefferson wanted to get his hands on that. He was vice president at the time, and he wanted to get his hands on that mastodon. And he sent emissaries up to, it's in Orange County, New York, and he couldn't get it. And then Peale himself, who was a wonderful artist and also kind of a showman and an entrepreneur and started the U.S.'s first natural history museum in Philadelphia, he himself personally went up. And through this interesting sort of, he was kind of a little bit of a con artist, and he managed to extract this mastodon skeleton from the guy who had found it and was showing it. He was charging like a quarter to see this disassembled skeleton. And he and Peale took it and put it together, as you would see now, you know, a reconstructed mastodon, pretty accurately, not entirely accurately. and showed it. And it was one of the first, you know, sort of blockbuster exhibits in the U.S. In Philadelphia in, I guess, 1801. Hmm.
So this was before anyone knew about dinosaurs, presumably.
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. Dinosaurs, you know, bits of pieces of dinosaurs started to be found. Maybe around 20 years later, we sort of start to see some of the first bits of dinosaurs. But before dinosaurs, you know, became dinosaurs, it was another 50 years before we got that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and to put this in perspective, and we tend to think, oh, dinosaurs, you know, this whole class of animals that was not very successful evolutionarily, but actually they were extraordinarily successful. I mean, they were around for, you know, what, 165 million years, something like that. And the modern human species has been here for 200,000, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, the whole word dinosaur, you know, when we call someone a dinosaur, it should really be a compliment. You know, to be a dinosaur is to be one, you know, tough hombre, as you say. Dinosaurs lasted a very long time, and they truly ruled the world, you know, and they kept mammals in their place. Mammals were these, you know, very tiny, shrew-like creatures, never got very big for the whole reign of the dinosaurs, although mammals have been around for quite a long time. And it was only 65 million years ago when a giant asteroid collided with the Earth, and a lot of things went extinct. That was the last major mass extinction, the end Cretaceous extinction, that did in the dinosaurs. It did in a lot of the marine reptiles. It ended a whole fauna, the Mesozoic fauna, that mammals, and many, many mammals went extinct too, I should add. Most mammals did. But a couple crept through, these tiny little creatures, and eventually gave rise to us. So, you know, we are here, I think it's increasingly agreed, only because of that extinction event.
The obvious question is, will humans at some point go extinct? What do you think?
Well, you know, there's many ways to answer that question. And the first one is, if you say one day and you mean at some point will humans go extinct, then the answer is, you know, definitely yes. All creatures, there's, you know, virtually all species have gone extinct.
So the question is, are we talking you know, millions of years from now, or are we talking a few
tomorrow,
centuries from now?
Right. That is a question I cannot answer. As it has famously said, you know, predictions are hard to make, especially about the future. I very purposely sort of avoid that question in the book. But I think, you know, I have to say one of the points of the book is, you know, some things do well with human disturbance. You know, rats seem to be doing, you know, really well.
Because they can coexist with humans.
Exactly. Some kinds of, you know, bacteria are going to do really well. Jellyfish seem to be doing really well. And if you ask yourself, okay, what can do okay in the presence of humans, it would have to be humans, right? I mean, there would be a good bet. So if I were, you know, just betting, like, you know, what species, you know, could probably survive, you know, a mass extinction caused by humans, then humans might be up on my list. You know, on the other hand, another point that I do make toward the end of the book, and it, once again, these are not my, you know, ideas. They're just ideas being bounced around by scientists, is that one of the things that seems to happen in a mass extinction, and I quote a British paleontologist who used exactly this line, is that the rules of the survival game change. For whatever reason, that is why the mass extinction occurred. The rules changed, and a lot of things could not play by these new rules. And so if you ask yourself, okay, do you want to be around in a time when the rules are changing and you don't know what's going to survive, your answer would be no. That's not a good time to be alive. That is just a low, you know, if you wanted better odds, you wouldn't want to be around then.
So did working on this project, writing this book, did this leave you really depressed?
It left me... It had two impacts simultaneously, which I think it, writing about natural history has on everyone, which is to have more and more appreciation for the extraordinariness of life on Earth and the remarkable ways that so many different species have found to survive. Survival strategies are fascinating, and the world is a incredibly rich, beautiful, you know, marvelous place as a result of that. So you gain a deeper appreciation for that, I think, than we have tend to have in our everyday lives, in which we encounter very, very few other species, except, you know, for microscopic ones, and our pets. And on the other hand, yeah, an extraordinary sadness for what's going on. There's just, it's just an sort of unspeakable losses, and the fact that they're happening all around us, and I think people are not really conscious of this event that's happening, that will be, I hope I impress upon people in the book, definitely the most lasting legacy of humanity. That was really the impetus for writing the book. I think people really need to be aware of this, you know, lamentable fact. Certainly, if we're going to do anything about it, we certainly need to be aware of it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.